in the Kaaba. Mm-hmm. This is the first point.
Very true.
The second point, again, is that destroying Masjid al-Haram or Masjid al-Nabi might be first because of going back to the structure at the time of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, and secondly, maybe because of the extension. Maybe Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is going to extend the limits of Masjid al-Haram, for example. We can conclude this point from some narrations, which tell us that at the time of Prophet Ibrahim and Ismail alayhi salam, Masjid al-Haram was larger and bigger than Masjid al-Haram that we have today. For example, in a narration in Al-Kafi, volume 4, page 209, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying, "Inna Ibrahim wa Ismail hadda al-Masjid al-Haram ma bayna al-Safa wal-Marwa." At the time of Prophet Ibrahim and Ismail alayhi salam, the limits of Masjid al-Haram was between Safa and Marwa. And we know that today is much smaller than this. So we can argue that maybe one of the reasons that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is going to destroy Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi is because of the fact that he is going to extend the limits of the mosque and taking back to the structure and limits at the time of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam.
By the limits, you mean the Baytullah itself or the whole masjid?
The whole masjid.
Okay. So can this new development plan that Saudi Arabia is doing, can be regarded as that?
They are not doing that because of the fact that they know about the limits of Masjid al-Haram at the time of Prophet Ibrahim and Ismail alayhim as-salam. They are doing that because of some of the reforms, because of the population and so on and so forth. But what Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is going to do, if these narrations are authentic, is out of his divine knowledge. Mm-hmm. He knows, because of his divine knowledge about the limits at the time of Prophet Ibrahim and Ismail alayhi salam, and will rebuild, especially Masjid al-Haram, based on the structure at the time of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. So seemingly they are the same, but what Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is going to do, if these narrations are authentic, is out of divine knowledge, mm-hmm. which at the end we will have Masjid al-Haram exactly like the one and the Kaaba, like the one at the time of Prophet Ibrahim and Ismail alayhi salam.
Thank you very much. Wherever you be, I'll be with you, 'cause you're the one.
And the last point that I would like to share is the fact that some of these narrations referring to the destroying Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi, they also refer to the Mosque of Kufa. Now, the point is that we know that the Mosque of Kufa is a symbol for Shia's Khilafat. Mm-hmm. Now, if Imam Mahdi alayhi salam wanted, and the Shia narrations wanted to claim that Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi will be destroyed, why the Mosque of Kufa has been mentioned in such narrations as well? Because the Mosque of Kufa is a symbol of only Shia's Khilafat. So we can, as you mentioned, we can conclude that the intention of these Wahhabi scholars referring to these narrations is not a good intention, mm-hmm. because they want to portray this act as a kind of anti-Islamic deed by Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But when we see that, according to some narrations, the Mosque of Kufa also will be damaged, the conclusion is that the intention of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is a good one. Maybe he wants to extend the limits of the Mosque of Kufa, also like the Mosque of Masjid al-Nabi in Medina and Masjid al-Haram in the city of Mecca. There are some narrations in this regard. For example, according to Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, mm-hmm. Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will go to the city of Kufa. He will order people to destroy the mosque of Kufa, hatta yabluga asasaha, so that the structure goes back to its original one. Again, I don't want to say that whether these narrations are authentic or not. The point is that the intention of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, if these narrations are true, is taking back all these holy places to their original ones.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh. So the gist of your explanations and presentation is that first and foremost, this hadith is weak. Secondly, in case it is true, so it has nothing to do with destruction, rather it's a sort of reconstruction with the intention of the extension of the limits of these masjids. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjah bin al-Hasan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
Roughly 1 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccines arrived in South Korea from the United States earlier this week. More Americans have been vaccinated than people in any other country, and the U.S. is now sharing, suggesting no strings are attached, with exceptions and flexibility.
The United States is not asking anything of any country to whom we're giving doses. We're not seeking to extract concessions. We're not extorting. Korea's situation is unique, as the president said when President Moon visited. The animating purpose behind that is actually about the protection of American forces and the forces who serve alongside American forces, the Korean troops who are standing shoulder to shoulder with us in that country.
The World Health Organization and infectious disease experts have criticized wealthy countries for hoarding vaccines, vaccine nationalism, even calling it vaccine apartheid. Experts say the U.S. gift to South Korea had various motives. The U.S. has restricted the use of its vaccine supply for South Korea to Korean soldiers that work alongside the 28,500 U.S. troops stationed in the country. U.S. efforts to contain China accelerated back in 2007 with the creation of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue involving Japan, Australia, India, and the United States. South Korea has been reluctant to join the grouping as it does not want to offend its main trading partner, China, which has condemned the Quad for targeting Beijing. South Korean President Moon Jae-in secured the vaccines during a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden in late May, as Seoul struggles to balance its alliance with the United States and growing trade with China. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, says it's still not clear whether the U.S. is ready to abandon what he calls an addiction to imposing sanctions on Iran. Addressing the IAEA's Board of Governors, Gharibabadi said Iran is in favor of continuing negotiations aimed at reviving the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, but that it would only go back to full compliance after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions.
The ball is actually in the court of the United States. They have to take very difficult decisions, and political one, of course, whether they are ready to put aside this policy of addiction to the sanctions or not. and whether they are ready to comply their own commitments under the JCPOA and also the other international obligations.
The Iranian envoy said Tehran is also seeking assurances that the U.S. would not withdraw from the deal again or abuse any mechanism within the JCPOA to reimpose sanctions. On Monday, the Board of Governors heard concerns about Iran's past nuclear activities from Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi. Grossi said there was a lack of progress in talks with Iran about the presence of uranium particles found in undeclared locations in the country. Ghali Bawadi responded by saying the agency is aggrandizing trivial issues that do not pose any proliferation risk and are not urgent. Instead, he argued, the agency should focus on the nuclear weapons program of Israel that's shunned all arms control and non-proliferation treaties.
I recommended the agency to put aside this political approach and not to convert this organization, not to turn this organization into a political organization. The IAEA should remain technical and professional.
As discussions on Iran come to an end at the IAEA, nuclear negotiators are expected to gather at Vienna's Grand Hotel for another round of talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA. Homolesky, Vienna.
After a raucous first debate, the second presidential showdown was quiet, where candidates focused on laying out their agenda and maintained a respectful tone, even when criticizing each other. With social affairs taking central stage, the debate tested the contenders' capability to address the country's social issues, such as health, education, and poverty.
Currently, there are some 7 million heads of household in our country that depend on charities to make ends meet. We need to set up a fund that ensures a sustainable income for these people.
To fight corruption, we need to fight unfair wealth distribution. We need to pay equal attention to the less privileged stratum of society.
If I am elected president, I will make changes to the circulars that allow astronomical salaries for certain managers. This way, we can help promote justice.
While the three-hour debate focused on social issues, journalists who waited outside the debate studio had other questions to ask, as the candidates got out one by one for a brief Q&A session. I was curious to know how each of the candidates would address regional issues, both politically and economically.
We are seriously pursuing close ties with our neighbors. Our region offers a 500 million strong market to us. But with regards to security issues, I have always stressed that the measures taken by late General Qasem Soleimani have turned Iran into a regional power. We have acted very well in the military field and diplomacy. But what's important is to build a bridge through the military field and diplomacy to expand our economic ties with our neighbors.
As oil-rich Iran is exploring ways to reduce dependence on the fluctuating oil market, this topic was among the FAQs, with journalists asking the candidates about what alternative economic engines they would employ to run the economy.
I will turn Iran into a food hub in the region. To this end, we will need more water and farmlands. We can expand our agricultural cooperation with other countries, especially those in Africa, which has so far been neglected.
To maintain impartiality, the National Television, also known as the IRIB, has arranged every step of the debate based on a lottery system, from the order of the candidates' entrance to the IRIB to the questions posed to them, and even their seats, are determined randomly. Candidates will face off for the last time on Saturday in the third debate. This time, the content of what the candidates said might be what the Iranian public remembers from the debate. Now the seven rivals have one more chance to stand out and woo more public support in the third and final debate, slated for June 12. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
To find a solution to the years-long war on Yemen, an Omani delegation has visited Sana'a and held talks with the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, and the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council. During the talks, Houthi hailed Oman for its efforts and stance beside Yemenis since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen.
The Omani delegation is exerting efforts, but its success is possible when the Saudi-led coalition admits it's failed in Yemen. However, it seems Saudi Arabia is still trying to impose pressure on Sana'a by tightening the siege to gain what it has failed to achieve in the war. We appreciate what our Omani brothers are doing and hope that they will succeed in ending the suffering of our people.
Observers say there's good progress in the humanitarian situation and Sana'a Airport might be reopened soon, as well as Hodeidah Port, which means that the fuel ships will be allowed to enter the country. They believe that the success of Oman's delegation will relieve the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
There's a keenness by Sana'a's leadership for the Saudi-led coalition to start taking steps to prove its good intentions to end the aggression. The first of these steps is to complete the humanitarian agreement, open Sana'a's airport and Hodeidah port, and allow the entry of oil ships. After that, other issues will be agreed upon, and this will build trust between the two parties. And the Omani delegation seems to be succeeding in that.
To meet the political leadership and discuss the possible ways to lift the siege imposed on Yemenis by Saudi Arabia. Since the beginning of 2015, the Saudi war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine.
Yemenis believe that the Omani delegation is finally succeeding in removing all impediments to their access to food and fuel. They say lifting the blockade is the first real step toward a nationwide ceasefire and the end of the brutal war on their country. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Since the turmoil of Brexit, the UK's Conservative government has splurged billions of dollars on expensive military projects, with plans to spend hundreds of billions more to project Britain's military might internationally. But while it's loosened the purse strings of military spending, the British government has tightened them on the country's underfunded public health system and on foreign aid, where it used to lead the way. The $5.5 billion cut will mean less relief for war-torn Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The UN Secretary General has called the move a death sentence. The cuts also affect aid to the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, and other life-saving projects in countries such as Syria, Ethiopia, and Afghanistan. Hundreds of charities, academics, and business leaders have signed a letter warning the government the cuts cast a shadow over the nation's role at the G7 and risk undermining its credibility on the world stage.
The amount of weapons that we are selling to be dropped on the head of the Yemenis on one side, and on the other side denying them any sort of support or cutting down those support, it really is outrageous, unacceptable.
The British government says its decision to slash foreign aid was a response to the economic shock brought on by the pandemic, meaning perhaps that once the health crisis blows over, foreign aid will go back to previous levels.
Despite the pandemic, government aid designed to promote the economic development and welfare of developing countries rose to an all-time high last year, with the largest contributions coming from the U.S., followed by Germany. Britain took third place.
There is a fraction within the sort of extreme right who always wanted to cut our contribution to these countries, and they never believed in helping, giving a helping hand. And I think this is an excuse. Right now, it's an excuse to actually give in to those section of the Conservative Party.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing a rebellion at home from MPs, including his predecessor, Theresa May, pushing the government to reconsider. Theirs and a growing number of other voices are urging Britain to be the world leader it claims to be. Saeed Puriza, London.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's Board of Governors, convenes a week-long meeting to discuss monitoring and verification in Iran, among other issues. Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi expressed concern over a lack of progress in discussions about the presence of nuclear material in four undeclared locations in Iran.
The Iranian government has reiterated its will to engage and to cooperate and to provide answers, but they haven't done that so far. So I hope this may change, but as we speak, we haven't had any concrete progress on any of the issues.
Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, says he's asked the agency not to use some unimportant issues dating to around two decades ago as an excuse to politicize Iran's case at a time when negotiations are underway to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known as the JCPOA. Grossi acknowledged there's nothing that indicates there is a danger when it comes to the safeguards-related issues, but stressed that the agency would not stop asking questions. In his latest report, Grossi also said the agency's access to Iranian nuclear facilities has been restricted since the 23rd of February as a result of a parliamentary law that obliges the government to go ahead with enrichment and other nuclear activities and to deny the agency broader or complementary access beyond the country's regular safeguards obligations. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the agency, valid until the 24th of June, the IAEA will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Grossi said an extension of that agreement was becoming increasingly difficult. Iran says it will transfer all the collected data to the agency and return to full compliance with the JCPOA after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions. Omar Lizgi, Vienna.
With more than a week left to the upcoming presidential election in Iran, the rivalry gets tighter. After a showdown between the candidates in the first debate, now they continue their campaigns on social media and national television. As the raucous debate revealed little information about the candidates' future plans, reporters try to extract more details through briefing sessions.
If we want to take strides in job creation, we need to pull the plug on sales of raw material. On top of them is crude oil. If one oil barrel gets us $50, its petrochemical products get us an added value of up to $2,000.
The upstream and downstream oil sectors have the potential to generate 880,000 jobs, but unfortunately, 25% of the petrochemical sector is not tapped into. If we operate this unused part, we can save $5 billion in petrochemical imports, and at the same time, we would generate thousands of jobs.
During his two terms as Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani did a lot with regards to foreign policy, clinching the 2015 nuclear deal with world powers, while retaining the country's intimate ties with its eastern partners, namely China and Russia. Now, as the Atomic Accord is facing a bumpy road ahead, most of the candidates believe it's not the master key for fixing Iran's economy.
The removal of sanctions isn't tied to negotiations with the U.S. We can instead neutralize the effect of the sanctions by tapping into myriad of resources in our country, such as rich mineral reserves.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. The second and third debates are scheduled for Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will be themed with cultural and political issues. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day on June 18th.
Well, the first debate was more pugnacious and less informative. It did not give a clear image of each of the candidates' policies. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the failure of Moscow talks, an Omani delegation along with the Yemeni negotiating delegation has arrived at Sana'a Airport as part of efforts to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen. Mohammed Abdus Salam, who headed the Yemeni delegation at the talks, said the meeting was aimed at pushing up the humanitarian situation that has been deteriorating due to the all-out blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
Well,
The talks are held to discuss the overall situation in Yemen, including the peace talks and the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Oman has always served as an arena for all Yemenis in political affairs, and today we are going to complete the efforts we made in Oman during the past months.
Observers say this move could make a difference in the political process, as Oman has always been beside Yemenis and realizes the circumstances of Yemen.
The Omani delegation is welcomed in our country because Oman has always been a good neighbor. We hope Oman could help us remove the current humanitarian crisis. We must have this point in mind that if the U.S. continues to link the humanitarian crisis in Yemen to the military realities on the ground, no progress would be made. Therefore, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen should be top on agenda.
The latest round of negotiations in Oman's capital, Muscat, failed to find a solution to the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. According to the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen has killed almost a quarter of a million Yemenis, caused outbreaks of disease, turned Yemen into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and brought the poor Arab country to the verge of famine.
Yemenis are optimistic about the Omani delegation visit to their country, saying Oman is capable of achieving what the UN envoy has failed during the past years and putting an end to the suffering of the war-ravaged nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As India continues to battle the deadly COVID-19 pandemic, the destitute Rohingya community fights it all alone. The community is not eligible to apply for vaccine since they are described as illegal immigrants. Rights activists say they are in desperate need of help as the virus has started raging across the camps.
First they started the deportation drive, then detention, and now the lockdowns. Why are all miseries for us? Why is the world silent? Don't we have the right to live? We have no work due to lockdowns, and now this virus is frightening us since we can't get access to any healthcare services here.
The COVID-19 pandemic has brought more miseries to the community, since most of them used to work in the unorganized sector. Now, due to lockdowns, most of them have lost their jobs, forcing them to live on charity, while hunger and poverty looms over the community. The refugee camps are cramped, and the spread of virus is inevitable, they say, since their makeshift shanties lean on each other with no sanitation, food support, or health care, since they are not included in the government's support programs. Most of them work as daily wage workers or scrap collectors to make a living, but the government restrictions and lockdown has left many out of work.
Some locals and NGOs are helping us with food and other essentials in these dire times. We, however, urge the UN Refugee Agency to play their part. We don't need just guidelines. We need access to vaccination.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different Indian states. In recent weeks, many of these refugees, including children, had developed COVID-like symptoms. But due to lack of testing facilities and shortage of vaccine, they're on their own. Most of them have resorted to home remedies and self-quarantine. Many, however, fear if they don't get access to medicine and vaccine, a humanitarian disaster awaits their community. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Lessons for Believers. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. So today, let's start talking about a new discussion. It is about taking lessons for believers, for the lives of believers. How should we have a good, positive, and a strong Islamic lifestyle? Well, one of them was keeping away from humiliation, which we discussed. Now, let's talk about keeping an open mind. Well, this means thinking independently and being just in one's judgments, not simply following others blindly and keeping one's eyes closed. If you look at Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he addressed Yazid's troops, "O followers of Abu Sufyan, if you're not following the teachings of Islam, then as free men, be independent of judgment. On what basis do you fight me now?" So see, what Imam Hussein alayhi salam is doing is he is making sure that his enemies get a very clear message that their move, their strategy is stooping below the life of an average common man who thinks. The second one is awareness. Discretion and desertion is discouraged via military court-martial and firing squads. A commander has never given troops permission to evade the battlefield before or after Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The Imam himself would like them to be all aware of the consequences of the impending action before any accepted challenge. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam did not deceive people into anything, right? If you look at the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, they clearly laid out the repercussions of what an individual or the society does. So this is a lesson for believers. We cannot keep others in dark, even for good motives. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing some lessons for believers in order to live a life that can be accounted and amounted for as a life of a believer. What is it that we're supposed to do? Well, one of the things is supporting the truth. Do you see that truth has been replaced by falsehood? We must be prepared to sacrifice everything that is precious in support of truth. And again, the infallible Imam has encouraged us to do that. And this is what I read in one of the books where Imam clearly instructed his followers that for haq, for truth, don't be afraid to sacrifice anything you have. Truth is the essence of Islam and fortifies the values emphasized in the Holy Quran. If you look at Hazrat Ali Akbar, who is the son of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he asked his father, "Are we not on the right path?" The Imam replied in affirmative. And then, what did Hazrat Ali Akbar alayhi salam said? He said, "Then it makes no difference if death comes to us or if we approach death." See, today we see in the world when the Zionist regime, it attacks the oppressed nation of Palestine, the believers, those who have faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they rise, they get up, and they fight for their rights. They fight for what is truth and haq. They fight against falsehood. Now, the question is, were they not giving sacrifices through this action? Well, of course they were. But these sacrifices are well worth it. This is in line with the teachings of Islam, where you sacrifice all you have for the rightful implementation of what is haq and truth. So with this, you know, we need to take lesson from the lives of infallibles where, we can live a life of a believer. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Srebrenica massacre remains the single worst atrocity conducted on European soil since the end of the Second World War. More than a quarter of a century later, as new details emerge in a recent report about how Western powers and the United Nations contributed to other atrocities committed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We now present you an article written by staff writers of the Middle East Eye. The piece is titled, Released Documents Reveal UK Planned Srebrenica Pullout Despite Being Aware of Imminent Carnage. Classified documents show the British government devised plans to withdraw troops from a besieged Muslim enclave at the height of the Serbian onslaught in Bosnia-Herzegovina in July of 1995. Despite being aware of mass killing of thousands by local Serb forces in nearby Srebrenica, nearly 8,300 Muslim men and boys were later found to have been murdered at Srebrenica after a Dutch contingent of the United Nations so-called peacekeeping force deployed in Bosnia withdrew from the town. The Srebrenica massacre, for which Bosnia's Serb leaders were later convicted of genocide, remains the single worst atrocity conducted on European soil since the end of the Second World War. More than a quarter of a century later, as the UK-based Middle East Eye News outlet reveals new details in a recent report about how Western powers and the United Nations contributed to other atrocities committed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The report, which used declassified British government documents about Bosnian crisis, also points to a new widely acclaimed Bosnian movie, Quo Vadis, Aida, that sheds new light on the tragic carnage in Srebrenica and what it described as the catastrophic failure of the United Nations peacekeeping mission in the region as Yugoslavia collapsed into war and violence. Quo Vadis Ida, directed by Jasmila Zabanic, a survivor of the near four-year siege of the major Bosnian city of Sarajevo by local Serb forces, the movie has been nominated as the best international feature film at the 2021 Oscars and as the best foreign language film at the British BAFTA Awards. According to the release documents, another Bosnian Muslim enclave of Gorazde, where British soldiers made up the main contingent of United Nations peacekeepers, came very close to facing the same fate as Srebrenica. The documents paint a vivid behind-the-scenes picture of Western leaders striving to choose the least worst option presented to them by their advisors, without much regard for the fate of Bosnia's Muslim population facing massacres and other atrocities that were overtly being carried out by Serbian forces. They further reveal that the then British Prime Minister John Major was reluctant to reinforce Gorazde in order to protect its population of more than 30,000, despite, as his private secretary put it, the distressing scenes now daily on our television screens. The documents further show that the British Defence Ministry drafted emergency plans for the evacuation of British troops from the area around Gorazde in July of 1995, at the exact moment that genocidal slaughter was underway at Srebrenica and a third enclave in Zepa had come under attack. Gorazde had come under Bosnian Serb attack in 1994 and again in May of 1995. Gorazde, located on a strategically vital crossroads and surrounded by towering cliffs, was highly vulnerable to another Serbian attack and potential carnage following the fall of Srebrenica and Zepa. The report noted that three eastern towns had been declared safe havens for Muslim Bosniaks by the United Nations Security Council in 1993, after the surrounding territory had been captured by Belgrade-backed Bosnian Serb forces opposed to Bosnia and Herzegovina's declaration of independence in 1992. The report also pointed out that the UN Security Council resolutions had also established that United Nations peacekeepers were only authorized to deter attacks on the three enclaves, but not to protect or defend them. Force could be used only in self-defense. On 16th of July 1995, with a final onslaught against Gorazde thought to be imminent, British plans, codenamed Operation Screwdriver, to evacuate 350 British soldiers from the town of Gorazde was finalized at the Ministry of Defence in London. According to the report, the disclosure of the British evacuation plans came as little surprise to men who served in the Army of Bosnia-Herzegovina during the war. It then cited Farid Buljubasic, who had served as a lieutenant colonel in the Yugoslav National Army before commanding Bosnian forces in Gorazde from mid-1992 to the end of 1994, as recalling that the so-called United Nations Protection Force, or UNPROFOR, were being led largely by officers who did not understand the nature of the war. Farid Buljubasic recounted that NATO aircraft in 1994 bombed Serb tanks that had already been destroyed. He said, "I would say that the role of the international community in general in Bosnia and Herzegovina was very dishonorable." He further emphasized, "My general impression is that they never understood the character of war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, that they were never neutral, that they faked execution of their tasks, and there is so much evidence that they were extremely inclined towards the Serbs." He added, "They ignored and disregarded the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina, as well as the army of Bosnia and Herzegovina. There was politics in all of that." The released documents also make clear that the British Prime Minister at the time, John Major, was determined that the United Kingdom should not be sucked into war with Bosnian Serb forces, and that his senior military commander, Field Marshal Peter Inge, fully supported that decision. Farid Buljubasic further pointed out that a group of 20 British Special Air Service or SAS soldiers had been hurriedly evacuated from Gorazde whilst the enclave came under attack in April of 1994. He noted they had been posted to the town as the eyes and ears of UNPROFOR commander Michael Rose, who was himself a British general. Buljubasic added, "When they came, they were pumped up, dressed, they had vests, all sorts of things, camouflage paint. The very moment it got troubling, they vanished." He said, as the attacks went on, and as the Chetniks or Bosnian Serb forces were getting close to Gorazde, one night those SAS, a helicopter came to pick them up. They took their stuff and ran away without letting anyone know, without anything. They just disappeared. They just disappeared and vanished in one night. The former Bosnian commander observed that the behavior of the forces of UNPROFOR, the United Nations peacekeeping forces, would have been identical to the Dutch at Srebrenica, if not even more shameful. Meanwhile, US President at the time, Bill Clinton, was expressing his frustration at the Bosnian government whilst they were struggling to defend themselves amid the United Nations imposed arms embargo, whereas the Bosnian Serb forces had inherited large amounts of weaponry from the army of the former Yugoslavia. During a telephone conversation with John Major, Bill Clinton was recorded to have said, "We could hardly blame the Dutch for leaving Srebrenica when the Bosnians themselves had already given up the fight." He further claimed, "The Bosnians made a habit of trying to make other people look bad in the press." The report points out that some sections of the British record of these Clinton-Major telephone conversations remain redacted, more than a quarter century later, on national security grounds, following the 2019 declassification of the bulk of the UK government papers on the period. Following the fall of Srebrenica and the attack on Zepa underway, British Prime Minister at the time John Major concluded that Bosnian Serbs would next turn to Gorazde, as the British ambassador in Belgrade reported that the Bosnian Serb army was under high after capturing Srebrenica with so little United Nations opposition and was dangerously unpredictable. However, John Major told both French President Jacques Chirac and US President Bill Clinton that he believed only diplomatic pressure should be applied in an attempt to save Gorazde. According to the report, the Americans regarded Gorazde as a problem for the British and French to deal with and regarded the defense of Sarajevo as a more serious strategic objective. The top British commander in Bosnia, Field Marshal Peter Inge, recommended that if the UK government decided its troops should remain in Gorazde, we should do so as robustly as possible, under a pure peacekeeping and humanitarian mandate option, and then seek a negotiated withdrawal with dignity, as the Dutch have done, but being prepared to use air power.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How
much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Firstly, we would like to congratulate the Imam of the time, Imam Sahib al-Asr wa al-Zaman, and the Imam, Imam al-Ra'uf, Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, and Imam al-Kathim, and all the Imam alayhi salam, on this being the day of the birth of the Blessed Lady, Bibi Ma'asuma salamullah alayha. And to all our dear listeners, especially as well, we congratulate you all on this being the birth of this Blessed Lady and the sanctuary of the Shia. This particular lady, you know, a person whose life had so many ups and downs, so much stress, so much distress, losing her father, losing her brother, traveling and trying to go and see him, getting stopped, getting sick, being buried in a land that was not familiar to her. And then this particular land that she was buried in becoming a center of learning of that particular school, that is the school of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. What is this place of Qom? What is relevant about it? How did it come to be? What are the significant factors, the significant places that surround it or are contained within this place? It is these questions that allowed the author of the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today. The book is titled Lady Fatima Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha of Qom. So in this book, these questions were answered, and inshallah, in our next segment, we will introduce the book further to our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
You are a miracle. You are a blessing from above. You brought joy to my soul and pleasure to my eyes. In my heart I can feel it. An unexplainable feeling. Being a father, the best thing that I could ever ask for. Just thinking of you makes me smile. Holding you, looking in your eyes. I'm so grateful for having you. And every day I pray that you'll find your way. You know I love you.
Welcome back to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. We are discussing the book Lady Fatima Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha of Qom. This book was written by Sister Ma'asuma Ja'far and was published by the Jamiatul Zahra Islamic Seminary for Women in the holy city of Qom. Now, the reason why this book was written was quite fascinating for me, and we will read from the introduction of the actual writer herself, who says, I distinctly remember sitting at her shrine, it is the shrine of Bibi Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha, upset because the Persian language was proving difficult to master. At the time, I made a pact with the noble lady, that is Bibi Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha, bless me in the task of learning this language, that is Persian or Farsi, and I will first use this knowledge to write your biography in English. Therefore, we see that this book by Sister Ja'far is written in English and is one of the few books that we have in the English language about this lady, if not the only book that has been written in English itself. And it's a very good book. It is a book that I myself have read and have benefited from before I came and studied in the holy city of Qom. And, you know, it is a good read and a worthy read for those who wish to come to Qom as well, just for the ziyarah and the visitation of Bibi Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha. So this book contains five sections. The first being the biography of Lady Fatima Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha. The second dealing with her journey to Qom. After that, it deals with the shrine of Lady Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha. For example, who was the first to build it?
when did the renovations take place, and so on and so forth. And what's also something that is noteworthy is that this book was written at a particular time when the extra renovations had not been done yet. So there were further renovations that were done afterwards. So therefore, it's seen that there needs to be another book written on the renovations of the Shrine of Bibi Ma'asuma, Salamu Allah Alayha. The fourth section is the holy city of Qom, the history behind it, certain places behind it. And the last section is the importance of the pilgrimage of Bibi Ma'asuma, or Lady Fatima Asuma, Salamu Allah Alayha. Why do you have to come? The hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and from Imam Jawad alayhi salam, and from Imam Ridha alayhi salam, as so on and so forth are mentioned. And the book then ends with the actual ziyarah, or the visitation recitation of this esteemed lady, which is something we should do, and which we do when we come and visit her at this, or rather at her shrine and her mausoleum. So inshallah, in our final segment of this episode, we'll be reading a segment from the book Lady Fatima Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha of Qom by Sister Ma'asuma Ja'far. Inshallah, please stay tuned.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, my dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. We have been discussing the book Lady Fatima Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha of Qom by Sister, or written rather by Sister Ma'asuma Ja'far. And as we mentioned previously, it was written in English. So obviously it is something that is beneficial for those of us who know English. And it's one of the only books written in English about this blessed lady. So anyway, a part of the book reads as this. So as we mentioned previously, the book has certain sections, five sections. We'll be reading from the second section, which is the journey of Bibi Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha to Qom, which obviously began in the holy city of Medina, and then on her way to Marv, which was in ancient Khorasan. So anyway, Bibi Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha, or rather, Sister Ma'asuma Ja'far writes in the second section, so 2.3, Lady Fatima Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha, journey from Sawa to Qom. When Lady Fatima Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha became ill at Sawa, she inquired from her companions how far Qom was. She was told 10 farsakh, approximately 60 kilometers. She asked to be taken to Qom, which at the time was a center of the Shia. Sawa, on the other hand, was hostile towards the family of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wa Alihi Wasallam. Alama Majlisli narrates, the more accurate narration is that when it became known to the family of Sa'd Ashari, the leading Shia family in Qom, at the time that Lady Fatima Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha was in Sawa and that she was ill, all of them went to Sawa to invite her to come to Qom. Prominent amongst this family was Musa ibn Khazraj ibn Sa'd Ashari, who was a companion of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. When he reached Lady Fatima Ma'asuma Salamullah Alayha, he took the reins of her camel and brought her to Qom, to his own home. Here she spent the last few days, 16 or 17 days of her life. Inshallah, until our next episode, my dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu Alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
What you heard?